consecutively. I think now at this point, we want to make sure that that sentence is actually served consecutively when the sentencing date occurs, and that takes place January 21st. At that time, the judge can decide if it's going to be consecutive or concurrent. Concurrent would mean he would serve all of his time at once. Mm. So since the maximum sentence was 30 years, he would serve approximately 85% of that, which would be about 28 and a half years.
I want to thank you all for being with us, Candace Leiger and Grace Franklin, co-founders of OKC Artists for Justice and Oklahoma City, and Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, law professor at UCLA and Columbia. We're going to continue this discussion, and we'll post it online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today's guest is Aaron Robertson of Oregon Wild. We'll talk about the proposed sale and privatization of Elliott State Forest on the southern Oregon coast.
Thank you to all of our new and renewing members during our winter membership drive. That makes KBOO one of the best community radio stations in the country. We fell a few thousand short of our goal of 55,000, so if you didn't have a chance to give, it's never too late. Remember, for the month of December, if you become a new member or if you increase your giving over last year, your gift will be matched by a number of local businesses and individual donors. Donate now at kboo.fm/give. Thank you once again for being the best supporters a station could ever ask for.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of music, nature, and storytelling, an experiential weekend workshop from January 8th through the 10th at Cedar Ridge Retreat and Conference Center in Vernonia, Oregon. Storytelling as a practice broadens our perspective and helps us understand the significance of our experiences. This workshop teaches the roots of storytelling and delves into the storyteller's mind. No prior experience required. And the deadline for registration is December 18th. Again, that's Music, Nature, and Storytelling, a weekend workshop January 8th through the 10th at Cedar Ridge Retreat in Vernonia, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Sean. Or is it the other way around?
Who cares? It's radio. Or podcast on the radio.
Is that a band?
No, that's TV on the radio. Pitch our show already.
Oh, yeah. Listen to our show.
Can you elaborate?
Listen to our show, please.
Sweet mercy, I'll do it. Our show is called Upside Down Trodden. It's informative and entertaining talk about issues important to the effort to create a more sustainable, more peaceful, and more equitable world for all life on the planet. We want to inspire you to think critically, feel deeply, and ask questions.
And we want to have a little fun along the way.
That's true.
You can find...
Can I say it?
You can find...
Can I say it?
Yeah.
Don't interrupt me again.
I won't.
You can find... Come on!
You can find us at kboo.fm/upsidedowntrodden.
Turning power inside out never sounded so good, especially on
KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com or by calling 503-230-2300.
If I were a tree,
in the middle of the woods,
in the middle of the woods,
with the sun and the rain,
with the sun and the rain,
I'd feel real good.
I'd make some shade
to cool my friends.
I'd
grow buds and seeds and leaves on my branches. Let the birds and the squirrels make homes. And chances are good that I'd be happy right to the end.
Right to the end.
Save some trees for me, Mister. Save some trees for when we grow up.
Yeah, well, fish, trees. Who cares?
Seen this one, you've seen them all.
Yeah, you know. And they're slimy and everything. KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Abe Proctor.
Yeah.
And me, Joe Uris. The number to call to be on the air, 231-8187. Here's what's happening. The Oregon State Land Board, led by Governor Kate Brown, a woman who in general most of us consider to be wise and good, are planning to sell the Elliott State Forest.
Who cares? It's just another tree land.
Well, it happens to be the home of 20 to 30% of all coho that develop in Oregon. It has enormous numbers of stands of old growth timber. It is a significant location for elk and other live wild creatures. It is, more important than all of that, a huge carbon sink. It is a place that holds carbon in place. This relates directly to global warming, and if you don't understand that part of it, we'll explain it to you.
Pulls carbon out of the air.
Yeah, it takes it up, holds it, buries it. Okay, and the larger question is a pattern that we're seeing where federal lands are being turned over to states to be managed by the states in the argument that, well, it's better to be locally managed. But what's really happening is that the states don't have the money to maintain these forests. Consequently, they will and often do sell off these lands to private developers, particularly to clear cutters. So we got interested in this, and particularly in view of the recent climate conference. And we've invited Aaron Robertson, who is the communications director of Oregon Wild, to come in and talk with us and talk with you all about what's going on and what's to be done and what the dangers of it all are.
So, Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
All right, so what's the deal, man?
The Elliott State Forest is 93,000 acres on the Oregon coastal range just east of Coos Bay. It is a significant state forest, and it is defined as a state trust lands, which means when Oregon became a state, we agreed to designate certain lands for schools. And this is the problem, the crux of the issue with the Elliott, is according to that agreement, the Elliott State Forest is supposed to maximize revenue for schools, but it also has to protect endangered species. Marble merlet are a seabird that is on the endangered species list. It is protected, and it nests in the Elliott. So that brought to a halt a lot of the egregious clear-cutting projects. Now, there's still logging going on the Elliott, but it slowed the development of that maximum revenue requirement. And so now the Elliott State Forest is losing money for the state, and it embodies this whole, you know, we'll turn over more public lands to the states because they'll be able to manage them. But if you can't manage them for old growth, clean water, endangered species, if you're losing money, then the state decides, well, maybe we need to turn this over. Maybe we need to sell it off to interests that may not be able to maintain those, what would we say, ecosystem services, which is the words for clean air, water, now, carbon sequestration.
This is raising a whole bunch of questions for me. It's a forest, right?
Mm-hmm.
It sits there doing what forests do. So I'm wondering how much actual management does that entail? But a few rangers to patrol?
It's rangers to patrol it. They like to maintain the roads to the places that are still being logged. It's over the entire course of its existence. Mm-hmm. The Elliott State Forest has provided less than $300 million to schools. So if you look at what was the most recent education budget in the state, $7 billion, 7.2, over the last 60 years, the Elliott State Forest has provided very, very little money for education funding, but the problem that they run into is the state says, oh, but somebody's going to sue us if we don't provide this little bit of money to schools, and so we have to sell it off. We have to log it. We have to start destroying endangered species habitat and endangering clean water.
So the revenue that the state claims is not materializing. This would largely be in the form of what, taxes and fees assessed on logging and other uses of the forest?
Yeah. They do the logging sales, and then they get a little fraction of that for the Common Schools Fund.
Now, this seems, and I'm sitting here from admittedly a layman's perspective, a really missed opportunity here to assess the true value of this forest. Are we measuring it only in the terms of the revenue it can provide for other state services? It seems to me it provides a pretty valuable service simply as a forest. And it would seem to me that any cost we might pay to maintain it would be negligible, or perhaps even a good investment in the future ecological health of the state.
And that's one of the problems with the way that the state land board has designed this, is the value of the forest is essentially only its logging value. And as you know, forests provide so much other services to us in terms of carbon sequestration, in terms of clean water, and monetizing those is more difficult. The state land board is kind of taking the easy way out and saying, well, if we were to log it all out, you know, what would be the value of that? But part of that is to just define what its value is for buying out its obligation to the Common School Fund. And that is kind of where we are right now with a number of organizations, all the way from Oregon Wild and other conservation organizations to the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, logging interests, some pension and real estate holdings companies out of Canada are all submitting forms of interest to stay involved in this process, with the ideal outcome being something that is able to continue to preserve the old growth aspects and endangered species habitat. But the state's asking for it all in one go. So they're going to essentially put a price tag on it and then say, all right, somebody give us the money and please maintain these values.
Okay, I'm a little bit confused in the bureaucratic aspect. This, explain to us, if you will, who appoints, what is the state land board?
The state land board is made of the governor, the secretary of state, and the state treasurer.
Okay.
And they sit as the, they decide what happens with the lands that are the Department of State lands, trust lands, and they vote on these things. Now, last year, they were very adamant to not privatize the Elliott, and then much more quietly this year said, well, maybe we can come up with some kind of public-private partnership, or maybe we can go full privatization. And the if no one can submit a plan, after all these people have submitted documents of interest, then they'll say, well, maybe we'll get rid of some of those other values that we were talking about. Maybe we won't have to protect as much old growth or endangered species. That's the ideal situation. And again, that comes back to this issue of privatizing public lands, and especially turning public lands over to state ownership, as they don't have the resources to manage them. And that's when you start losing these qualities that we need in terms of dealing with climate change, in terms of not having more species go extinct.
Well, you know, this is a good small example of what's happening actually all over the world, and certainly in the United States. That is, it isn't the bad guys in the federal government that do it. They just turn it over to the states and let them be the bad guys that do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lovely way of Congress to wash its hands of its involvement in all this. And meanwhile, I assume people know this, a recent deal was made to save the planet at COP. I love that name.
Mm-hmm.
And that the result of that is good intentions and what seemed to me to be virtually unenforceable agreements to reduce carbon dioxide in the air and the methane in the air. And nothing that I would say will do anything to stop global warming. So I see this as not a micro, but a small example of the a typification, if you will, of a process that is under the eye of most people. And I doubt that many of our listeners, who are mostly pretty aware on environmental issues, are aware of this. And what I'm interested in hearing from are people who have their own view on this, other than the three of us sitting here. But I want to emphasize that the decision to have this show is about what I perceive, and I think Abe perceives, and I know that Arden Wild perceives, as a growing danger to the basic storing of carbon dioxide through the use of living things. And I really am worried about this pattern, especially since there is no actual commitment by states or counties or the federal government to the process of stopping global warming.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial. You can also hear us over the internet tubes at kboo.fm. We're very interested in your take on the pending or prospective sale of the Elliott State Forest. You can give us a call at 503-231-8187. You can also leave a comment on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/Abe and Joe. So I want to ask you, Aaron, is this sale a done deal, or is there still a chance for people to put a stop to it?
Well, one of the things that we worked with some state legislators, primarily Tobias Reed in the last session, was to create a state trust lands program that would allow the state to purchase out parts of the Elliott. Now, it becomes more problematic if the state land board continues going along this course and says we have to do it all in one go. But Washington has a model program where they identify lands that are that have other obligations that are primarily used for resource extraction but have a higher ecological value. I would say that in Oregon, the Elliott would definitely be that, and is able to purchase those back into state ownership to buy out their other obligations. Unfortunately, that legislation died at the last minute. Representative Catty McEwen switched a vote at the last minute where it looked like it was going to pass. And so we don't have that instrument to start essentially taking parts of the Elliott out of their common school fund obligation. So if we could get something like that to pass in the short session or in the coming 2017, maybe we could start that process. It's a bit of an uphill battle based on the timeline that the state land board has put on us, but there is still a chance that we can start converting this. And whether that is having parks take Oregon Parks take over part of it, whether it becomes some part of Department of Forestry that's managed in a conservation manner, there is still a chance, but it's going to be an uphill battle.
Well, you know, when I look at this, this is a micro example of what I consider to be the macro reality of American money issues, public money issues, which is, of course, that the 1% of 1% pay far too little in taxes. And in the end, there is too little money to take care of the basic needs of people and the environment, or either of them, really, because of the incredible, insane politics that dominate Washington, D.C. at this point. And I see this as, you know, if you watch the process as it goes downhill, this is the bottom of that hill. This is a place where we can walk in wonder, apart from that aesthetic issue, where a whole industry, the salmon industry, the coho industry, is endangered, where all kinds of animals are endangered, and where, and most important perhaps, this is land which, left alone or managed properly, could very well be a major force in keeping the global warming at bay.
Oregon has amazing carbon storage capabilities. 6 of the top 10 national forests that store the most carbon are located in Oregon.
Wow.
So we have a unique opportunity. We have this amazing ability in our state to contribute in this outsized way to the global warming and carbon mitigation problems. And the way we do that is by not recklessly clear-cutting our forest lands. But anybody who's taken a drive through the Coast Range can see that for that, that's mostly private and state lands, that is clearly happening. Big 120-acre clear cuts with little buffers between them, and then there's the next clear cut. And if we want to mitigate our carbon impact, having larger rotation cycles, having bigger buffers, reforming the way our state allows forestry to be done can go a big way to helping us mitigate global warming. And that extends to the national forest, especially, is that we keep hearing that we need to up the cut on the national forest. Well, if you're turning national forests over the states, they're going to go back to those giant clear cuts. So keeping our national forest lands public, not turning those over to the states, is definitely something we can do to help mitigate climate change.
Well, there's another irony in all of this. An old friend of mine who I haven't talked with in years, a lawyer, Paul Dewey, was living in Sisters and undertook, I don't know whether he was sponsored by anyone or how he did it, but he undertook actually on foot to examine lands that were claimed to be old growth or claimed not to be in Central Oregon and elsewhere. And in his amazing walking camping tour, he discovered that many places designated as old growth weren't. Many places that were old growth were not designated as old growth. In other words, the map was a mess. The Forest Service had not done its proper job. I love calling it the Forest Service. I think that's appropriate. And in actuality, I can't say that there was corruption, but it is very odd that nothing was accurate. I mean, lots were not accurate. Maps were not accurate. Information was not really available. All of this, despite the fact that you can use satellites and other forms of measurement, looking at things, you could have a more accurate picture. We're now getting a more accurate picture, but at that point, it really didn't exist, and I'm not sure it exists much in the public awareness now. The reason why I was anxious to do this show was because I don't think most of the people who are very concerned, we have an audience of very aware people generally at KBOO, are aware of this project. Because this is an example, an absolutely clear example of the consequence of inadequate funding from the government, mm-hmm. federal government, to the states, and the states, in response, destroying an incredibly valuable, many, many thousands of years resource. So that's why I wanted to do this. I do know we have some phone calls, so maybe we should go to the phones.
Sure. What do we have, Steve? John, good morning.
Good morning, John. 231-8187. Hi.
Good morning. Two comments. One, what is Oregon's carbon footprint? Do we have a zero carbon footprint, or how much more CO2 are we putting into the atmosphere than our forests are taking out, whether it's state, federal, private, trees in somebody's backyard? It doesn't matter. What does it all add up to? In the city of Portland's climate change plan on page 150, they acknowledge that all the trees in Portland, Forest Park, Mount Tabor, all of it, takes only 1% of the amount of carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere out. So it's a joke. And then I do think that, yes, the economic value, as we have to do it, of the recreational and commercial fishing, hunting, drinking water, those need to be added up as part of the cost benefit. And the people need to see that their schools are benefiting from the commercial fishermen, from the recreational fishermen, from the recreational hunters, and they're benefiting from having potable water come out of their faucet. The economic value of that needs to be calculated. Those are my two directions of thought on the issue.
Okay. You have a comment?
Responding to your second comment, I think that's absolutely right, that we need to not just look at the value of the Elliott as just logging, but also the recreation potential, the clean water. And we'll have to wait to see what the actual appraisal that the state does is, but I think that that point is spot on.
And I want to make a small point relating to what you've just said on the phone. It is really important to understand that every little percentage is part of a huge percentage when you multiply it by all of the forests or multiply it by the enormous amounts of wetlands or whatever that there are in the state, in the country, in the world. And this is a process that continues to amaze me because there's so much denial around all of this. A little here, a little there. Go ahead.
I don't think we should, you know, pat ourselves on the back because we have 6 out of 10 of the most carbon sequestering forests in the country. The bottom line is, does Oregon as a state add more carbon dioxide and methane to the atmosphere than its forests can remove?
I would guess
all the methane is converted to CO2.
I would guess the answer to that is yes. Like industrial parts of the world everywhere, we are net emitters of carbon, and that's something we need to turn around. And preserving intact forests is one way we can do that.
Anyway, thanks a lot.
Don't wait. Thank you. Goodbye.
Yeah, thank you for the call. 231-8187. If you're just tuning in, of course, this is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. We have a guest from Oregon Wild, and Aaron, and he's talking with us about specifically about the forest called the Elliott State Forest. Mm-hmm. I can do this. Anyway, we do want to hear from you. Who's next? Charlotte, you're on the air.
I see that the economic value of a number of these things are not being considered and should be considered, but I also have a question about the future of the state and the I'm not even sure how you create economic values for the whole watershed that creates pure drinking water, for example, for a number of people of the state. I mean, I don't even know how you figure these out. But looking into the future, I am curious. I think that the state has some kind of a policy on the issues of climate change, and climate change is not only about the carbon dioxide in the air and the issues of warming. It's beyond that. It's about all the changes that are happening, and some of those changes include the potential for greater drought and the need for protection of watersheds. So I'm very curious about the bigger picture in terms of Oregon State policies on climate change in the future. And I have another question specifically about why do we know why this vote went down that you're talking about, and what can be done about possibly reversing that vote with the legislature at the beginning of the year coming up? And I'll just go off the air and you can answer my questions.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
So the legislative vote essentially came down to two parts. One was the contract the state had when it took ownership of certain parts of the Elliott State Forest said that you are not allowed to sell tracts. The state sold tracts, and there was a lawsuit that was pushed forward by a number of conservation organizations, which essentially catalyzed the slowdown and the stopping of a lot of the clear cuts on the Elliott State Forest. So there was a piece of legislation that retroactively said what the state did was just fine. And that was essentially paired with the state lands transfer legislation that Tobias Reed had. And those were essentially going forward together. The timber industry hated the state lands trust transfer, and conservationists were leery about retroactively making what the state did legal. But there was this uneasy alliance that nobody was really happy with. But this switch to by Representative Catty McEwen at the last minute to kill the Transfer Act also then killed the retroactive. It was okay that the state sold these lands part of the legislation as well.
So where is it now?
It died. It went to the floor and it died.
Which means that Kate Brown's advocacy of selling this off is very likely to go forward?
And we need Kate Brown. This is a place where she is uniquely in a place to lead and say and change the parameters of what the state land board is doing right now. Because we have Ted Wheeler, who is on the state land board now. He is running for the mayor of Portland. Mm-hmm. Not going to be presumably on the state land board when the final decision is made. We have Gene Atkins, who is not going to be a member of the state land board when this decision is made. So it's really up to Kate Brown, who is ostensibly running unopposed at the moment, to demonstrate some leadership here. She is the one, again, presumably, that will be there when the final decision is made. And so she can be the one to lead and say, we need to retain these values. We need to redefine how we're going to go about if this is a sale, if this is a transfer.
So if I were just me out there, if I wanted to have some impact, I think a letter to Kate Brown saying essentially don't sell Elliott State Forest would be the appropriate move?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Huh. Okay, well, let's hope people do that. I'm for that.
You said that the governor's in a unique position to lead on this. Why do you say that? What makes
your
position unique?
Because none of the other members of the state land board will be there when the decision is actually made.
I see what you mean. Okay.
A lot of power.
And apparently, given that she's running unopposed, she'll face no political reprisal, one would think.
Yeah.
But one could also say that political reprisal be damned. She should do the right thing here and preserve this forest.
Right, exactly. It is the right thing to do.
Yeah, and we want to hear from people who disagree with this whole concept of preserving old-growth forests or mixed-growth forests. We also want to hear from those of you who are concerned about this issue and want more information or whatever. We have a nice resource with us in Aaron. And I really am interested in this because I think this is one of those under-the-radar things that's going on consequent to the inadequacy of the federal government in its tax structure and in its politics and in its real interest in destroying the benign federalism that protects forests. Let's hear from you. 231-8187. Larry, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, this really doesn't, let's say it doesn't address the need for revenue for the state and the Elliott State Forest extraction of timber,
mm-hmm.
but and this would be let's say a massive shock for the need for dimension lumber, which is all over the country building houses mainly.
Mm-hmm.
So you could eliminate the need for dimension lumber with steel framing, and there was 10-15 years ago a business in Canby, and that was right next to the fairgrounds, and they had set up encourage the use of steel framing to frame houses. So basically, you can frame a house all with steel. All your dimension lumber would be substituted, or you could say that substituted, but you'd be using all your framing would be steel.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you might want a sheet with plywood, the roof and the sides, but you could massively reduce the use of lumber to frame buildings. Now commercial construction is used for partition walls and stuff and hotels and high rises and that sort of thing, because you really reduce the dead load on your floors that way. So,
mm-hmm.
And obviously this would just be a massive shock to the whole wood products industry, jobs and that sort of thing. But you could just, maybe 60-70% of the need for dimension lumber could be reduced immediately if you would frame with steel. And it's simply, you roll out, they have a way to Well, it's just like a roll of sheet steel, and then they have dies, and mm-hmm. then you could use it. They'll be depending on the strength of the member that you need. That use different thicknesses of metal, and so you can simply roll out package of whatever it is you need to frame a building on site in a small manufacturing.
Yeah, I see your point.
Yeah,
and I thank you for the call. We'll talk about that a little bit. A couple of things come to mind immediately. The first is that there is a great deal of use of resources in creating steel. The second is that there is a counter trend going on right now where there's a great deal of discussion of using all wood framing for high rises in the Portland metro area. And I don't know where that wood comes from. I don't know what the implications of that are for the forest, but it scares the hell out of me.
There are some very interesting politics going on with these new wood framed high rises, because we are told, oh, these are the future of sustainable building. One of the problems being Oregon's timber is not FSC certified. That's it's a sustainable forestry
term.
And there was a campaign for many years by the Kitzhaber administration to lower FSC standards so that LEED certified buildings could use Oregon timber, which is kind of like saying, oh, you're not doing well enough, let's lower the bar, rather than encouraging more small woodland owners to actually practice more sustainable forestry techniques.
Well, and there's another set of issues that really worry me about these high rises, since we're on the topic. It seems to me that the gluing process really needs to be vetted for toxins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've been around plywood at all, you know that it outgasses. And the idea of living in an outgassing environment forever, it seems troublesome to me. And there's a whole host of chemical processes that are necessary, including fire retardants and so on, to make these buildings viable and safe. And nobody's talking about that, as far as I know. Anyway, we it's a little off our topic.
I think the caller raises an important point, though.
Yeah.
Over the long term, wood is not a sustainable building material. If we use wood to meet all of our building needs, we end up with no forests, and that's the direction we're heading now.
Uh-huh.
He's right that reclamation of and or uses of other materials, that's something we're going to need to turn our attention to.
Yeah, and I think I don't know the functional equivalence in comparing timber to steel in construction, frankly. I have no idea. I know that it would have to be, for steel to work for the kind of thing we're talking about, it would have to be in the form of I-beams. I don't know how thick they have to be. I don't know how they're processed. It's just outside of my area of expertise. Is it in yours?
I've got nothing.
Okay, fair enough.
All
but
right.
he raised an interesting point. We mm-hmm. want to hear from you, 231-8187. We're talking about the two things. We haven't really talked about the fact the federal government is handing over to the states various forest lands and wildlands in a way of shedding responsibility, putting it on the states, who in turn have no money and therefore end up virtually selling off those lands. I'd love to hear from you.
James, good morning.
Good morning. So I think the one thing that also needs to be discussed is the fact that, you know, it's like if we want to talk about, you know, sustainability is a wave of the future. We gotta stop using like these mass clear cuts. You know, we have to cut down our consumption. Because I mean I travel to the coast a lot, and it just breaks my heart to see whole stretches, whole huge acre patches of forest just gone. And they tell you, well, you know, when we cut down trees, we replant. And it's like, well, that's fine and well, but that's like somebody killing your grandma, but then saying, oh, well, we gave you a newborn though, you know. And it's
Ouch.
Like
they, that's quite an image. Anyway, go ahead.
You know, and it really comes down to how the older trees interact with the environment as opposed to newer trees. They don't have the type of carbon storage. They don't have the strength of root. You know, you're literally taking out a very important member of the forest community, but you know, everybody's under the guise that if we keep replanting that, oh, well, you know, that's going to make everything better. But it really doesn't in the long run, because it takes so long for you to be able to harvest those trees anyway.
You raise an excellent point that we replant, but we replant with one species. We don't create, we cut down a forest and then we put up a plantation and we spray it with pesticides that get in drinking water to keep away any other plants from growing, so that our one plant, our Douglas firs in the Coast Range, can grow up. And there are other consequences that you touched on. Runoff from all of these clear cuts, without the big root systems, you get a lot more runoff, both of soil erosion, but also those pesticides you just dumped on that land. And when you cut out the old growth and you create a clear cut, that soil does not retain water. So in terms of exasperating drought, when you do these clear cuts, the city of Yahats had half of their drinking watershed clear cut and had to do a bunch of water rationing this summer. They're a coastal community, but the water that normally kind of slowly comes through their watershed because the trees are there, without the trees there, it just washed on down.
Yeah, I think that's important. I also wanted to mention another thing. The forest circus and the forest industry have done a thing called corridors. If you drive down a lot of highways, for example, the Van Dusen corridor going to the coast, it looks great. You can see a beautiful complex forest on either side of the highway. That's true for 100 yards. Or what I don't really know, 200 yards, let's say. But beyond that is clear cut. Beyond that, the hills are falling away. You can see that if you walk through those corridors. So what really is being done is a conscious effort to make it pretty while it's making it become a disaster. And I that really bothers me. I want them to clear cut right up to the road so you can see exactly what's going on. So the dishonesty ends.
Did that answer your question, caller? He's gone. Okay. The caller brought up something very important, and Aaron, you reinforced it. I'm glad we went there. The idea that simply replanting clear-cut areas of forest, while necessary in the wake of a clear-cut, is certainly not the answer. A stand of old-growth forest is a climax ecosystem. It's far more than the sum of its parts. Mm-hmm. It's much more than the trees that make up the bulk of the biomass there. It supports a huge diversity of organisms, plants, animals, fungi, on and on and on. And when you just wipe it off the face of a mountainside, you're dealing with a whole set of problems that need to be addressed, and replanting the trees is only the first step.
Well, yeah, and including actual change to local climate.
Yeah.
You know, when you take off a ridgeline of trees, you're changing the dynamics of the airflow there. And that in turn changes the patterns of water and so on in that place. It's really a classic example of ecological foolhardiness to be in denial about the impact of clear cut. Our producer Steve says it takes 500 years to grow a forest, and yeah, but it only takes a couple of years to cut it down.
And looping this back to the importance of the Elliott, the Coast Range, other than the Siusla National Forest, is private and state owned, and that is what allows these massive clear cuts. So if we want to have any of these 500-year-old forests, preserving the Elliott is one of the few chances we have right now in the Coast Range to do that, because everything else is just getting hammered.
So again, I guess the person to talk to if you're concerned would be Kate Brown.
And talking to your state legislators about starting reforming the Oregon Forest Practices Act that allows these big clear cuts, these short rotation times, and then we take the raw logs and we ship them off.
Oh, yes. Well,
not to throw in another dimension to our discussion.
Well, yeah, you can't. I'm glad you brought that up, though, because you can't even argue that you're getting jobs for Oregonians in exchange. All right, let's take care of a little biz and we'll go back to the phone. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on alternative radio, social and political critic Henry Giroux speaks on the costs of neoliberalism. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Zahra Bilou from CARE discusses violence and intimidation that American Muslims are facing. Then, Flashpoints presents interviews with Dr. Mads Gilbert and Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb about the Israeli occupation of Palestine. At 11, it's Stage and Studio, a weekly live show featuring the best of performing, literary, and media arts in Portland and beyond. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Andre Middleton interviews photographer Margaret Jacobson, who likes to capture the heart, soul, and spirit of a person in her photographs. All that and more coming up today on KBOO. And I should mention, we just finished a membership drive. And if you didn't take that opportunity to become a member of KBOO, you can still do it. Log on to KBOO.fm and click on the tip jar.
Yeah, there are no fines for being late.
Just that easy.
Anyway, listen, we're here talking essentially about the Elliott State Forest and the plan of Kate Brown, the governor. Remember, she is the governor. To probably sell that off in order to raise revenues that she perceives as necessary. This is part of a larger issue where all over the nation, the Congress is handing lands back to states which have no money to manage those lands, and then we're seeing those lands turned over to private enterprise, and often for the purpose of clear cut or super grazing or whatever.
And one issue that we haven't touched on that's much more recent is Representative Greg Walden's proposal for Southern Oregon forest lands.
What does
lands.
He want to do?
He recently floated a proposal just last week that in the Klamath Basin deals that are going on, that are on the verge of collapse, he decided to come in at the last minute and say, well, let's take out dam removal from those agreements, but I'll add in giving away 100,000 acres to both Klamath and Siskiyou County in Northern California of our national forest lands over
what?
To the county. And the county would get to select what those forest lands were. It was a proposal. It's not, you know, the senators immediately came out and said, you can't just give away public lands.
Wait,
like that.
Would you have
that?
To move the border? How does that work? I don't get it.
But, you know, in this discussion of national public lands being turned over to states or counties in this case, this is an important thing that this is happening not only in the Elliott, but it's being proposed here in Oregon.
Yeah, what I find interesting about all of this is that it's all of this is so underreported. The Oregonian has turned into a, I don't know, what do you want to call it, a shopper magazine or something. It's all of the great reporters that were there, most of them are gone, and the last of them are leaving. This month or next month, the end of this year for sure. We don't have a daily newspaper of any extent anymore, even with criticism. The Oregonian was very useful. What we do have, and I'm glad they exist, are these weeklies that are carrying that burden, but they are not equipped to really give us enough of the news that we need. So, you know, we have the Tribune, we have the Mercury, which is, weird. And young people.
You've heard of the internet, right?
Right.
There's a good deal of journalism and commentary happening there. I just wanted to let you know.
No, I know that.
Okay.
Thank you, though.
Appreciate that.
Thank you for keeping me up to date on the internet.
Let's go back to the phones.
All right. 231-8187.
Harry, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I believe in protecting old-growth forest, especially when I found out the Douglas fir tree can actually live between 700 and 900 years. How come they don't use a selective cutting through these areas versus just, you know, clear cutting?
There actually is in the Elliott State Forest Management Plan selective thinning. The state hasn't done any of that. So they're about 5 years into their 10-year management plan, and they are not following through with what you're talking about is the selective thinning, which kind of begs the question when we're talking about losing revenue, but you're not fulfilling that management plan, why don't you do that as part of it? And I don't know the answer to that, but there is that is supposed to be part of how the Elliott is managed, is these plantations that were densely planted years ago that are now too densely planted to be a natural forest. They do have parts of that plan that is supposed to go out and thin it, and they're not doing that.
And of course, it's harder from a logging perspective to do thinning.
To do selective, yes.
You know, it's just, yeah. it's both more dangerous and more difficult.
Well, how about a ballot measure saying, through the state of Oregon, any logging has to be selective cutting.
Hey, I'm up for that. You yeah. should start that effort, sir.
I think it's a good idea. I don't know where it would go in the process, but I think your point is well taken, and you're not wrong at all. Obviously, if you must log, selective logging makes real sense.
And there are some great small woodlot owners here in Oregon that are trying to do that. They're not being encouraged because our standards of forestry are so low through the Oregon Forest Practices Act. And again, going back to this watering down or trying to watering down of LEED building standards, that's going to make people lose incentive to do more of the sustainable, good kinds of forestry that we want to see. So we should be encouraging those people, not making it so just anybody who's clear cutting on a hillside can get those sustainability credentials.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, listen, I appreciate your point, too. It's really an interesting and complex issue. Forest management is a very, very tricky business. I am specifically concerned, though, with this plan, because once you turn this land over unrestrictedly to private contractors and so on, they're going to want to see their investment returned as quickly as possible.
And it will look just like the rest of the Coast Range.
Right. And so long, Coho.
Mm-hmm.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO. Who's next? Bob. Good morning.
Yeah. Well, here's the guy, you know what I'm saying?
Okay. Bye, Bob.
Don, good morning.
Don, are you there?
Are you there?
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I'm here.
What's on your mind?
Yeah, Bob. I think Bob got me distracted there. I don't know. What's the alternative then? I mean, you know, framing houses with steel studs and steel construction, you're putting carbon in the air because it takes resources to make steel. And, you know, wood is, you know, you don't want to cut down trees because they produce oxygen and clear the air and they're pretty and the forest is wonderful. So my question is, after all this brouhaha, what's the solution? And I will take my answer off the air, please.
Thank okay, you. That's okay. A very good question.
Okay, Aaron, you're up now.
Well, I think we kind of touched on some of that just a few moments ago, is trying to encourage the more sustainable forestry and having some of these practices actually replicated and encouraged at the state level that aren't these massive clear cuts that do help protect endangered species and water, but don't necessarily, you know, make us absolutely no cut. I mean, I think that there is a compromise in there that both maintains, you know, public lands, forests, but also doesn't deteriorate our watersheds and drinking water. So it's finding the way to encourage people to use best practices and not keep cutting off of our Coast Range for short-term gain.
So the question, how do we wean ourselves from the use of wood as a very useful product, which it is, mm-hmm. That's a very complex one. And the answer, I think, touches on a whole number of fronts. Reclaiming already harvested materials is one way. Finding alternate materials like steel and other metals is another. Going still farther into things like straw bale construction, into new composite construction materials made from hemp that are being researched in
hemp.
European countries.
Oh, wait,
well, don't go there, Joe. Don't go there, Joe? It's a complex question. The answer is going to have to come from a number of fronts, both industrially and ecologically.
Yeah,
but there is no easy answer to that question. Is what I'm
getting at. I do urge people to contact Oregon Wild to talk with people there. And Aaron here is able to come on and talk about stuff that neither Abe nor I are too expert on. But we do want to hear from you. 231-8187.
Stuart.
Hi. I'm coming to the program a little late, but it sounds like the Elliott Forest is kind of in the crosshairs of some deal. And this is just to be sure I have a clear concept of the place we're talking about. This place is sort of in between Drain and Reedsport. Is that right?
It is just east of Coos Bay.
Yeah.
So you got the right place, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the line between Coos and Douglas County over there.
Okay, 30-some-odd years ago, I used to live down there in the general area. And at that time, and I don't know what finally happened, there were various endangered species attempts at protecting it through endangered species, marbo, murrelet, but more pointedly, there was a species of loon that was indigenous to the area, and I don't know what happened. I'm just curious if anything like that is being contemplated.
That's one of the problems with the state is having with the Elliott State Forest is they'd like to log a lot of it, but the presence of the marbled murrelet is the thing that stopped them from doing that. So that the presence of that species has helped save and preserve parts of the Elliott.
And it's important also to remember this is where a heck of a lot of the coho spawn.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want a fishing industry, if you want to have fresh salmon on your table ever, then you better be considering this issue.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you.
You know, it just occurred to me maybe a way to save this forest and others like it is to import other endangered species and put them there. Round up like principled conservatives and we could move them in. And then it would be a protected habitat.
How about pandas?
That could work too.
We could plant bamboo. I mean, you know. No, really, this is our responsibility. And what I said earlier is really important. Everything about the environment in Oregon is routinely underreported, if reported at all, in the press. The regular TV news, which is blah, blah, always with a feel-good story at the end, absolutely irresponsible.
That's right. It's that kind of biting insight and analysis that people tune in for, by the way.
Exactly.
Right, okay, continue, please.
So we really need to understand that things are at a place of crisis in the world. And the way you approach that is not just with a grand scheme that amounts to very little in Paris, but at the local level, struggling for the maintenance of those resources that are so valuable and so key to keeping the world a cooler, better place. And this is a great example of that. Saving this forest is something that can be done, that should be done, and that would, under normal circumstances, probably even be done. But the structure of things, the way in which things are managed by Congress, and the way in which the state is responding to that, and the way in which there is a scarcity of monies, because, once again, we will not tax the rich to the extent that they would reasonably be taxed, not to take their fortunes, just to have them share. All of that blocks the process of protecting the environment. And this is a classic example that the Elliott Forest is really, really in the crosshairs at this time.
So, Aaron, before we go, why don't you let our listeners know how they can make their voices heard on this issue?
Contact Kate Brown's office and the State Land Board and let them know that you would like to keep the Elliott in public ownership. And failing that, make sure that anybody who is going to be managing the Elliott manages it for old growth and conservation values, clean water, endangered species. It's a rare place on the Oregon Coast Range, and we need to protect it.
Yeah, I think we have time for one quick call. Mike, you're on the air.
Thanks for summing things up for us today. That was fantastic.
It's all about demand. I think I don't know all the solutions, but I can say a fundamental thing is about demand. So changing the demand, smaller homes, more density, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I think it's about demand economically and politically. Can I remind people, save the date, January 5th. There's a Washington State hearing on the proposed crude oil mega terminal in Vancouver.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. And I'll be emphasizing that starting next week. This is a crucial hearing. There should be thousands, not hundreds, thousands of people demanding that we don't ship coal and oil and gas through Vancouver, through Oregon, to a terminal just so it can be sold overseas to some other guys.
Yeah, Shreveport, Louisiana. We don't want that here.
And, no, we don't.
And thousands. Let's fill the fair. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Yeah, what a great call.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very appropriate.
All right. Well,
thanks.
I think we're at the end.
You know, I
thank
think
you both for having me on.
Yeah, you bet.
We have come to the end. And if you're interested, Oregon Wild is easy to find on your computer. And I'm sure they could probably use a little money themselves.
Aaron Robertson, thank you for joining us today on the Abe and Joe Show. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody, as always, who calls in to make this a great show.
See you. You stay tuned, because the best in music and public affairs programming is right here on KBOO.
Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Ornette, Made in America, showing Thursday, December 17th at 7 p.m. Released in 1985, Ornette, Made in America, explores the rhythms, images, and myths of America seen through the eyes of an Ornette Coleman's imagination and artistic evolution over three decades. Again, that's Ornette, Made in America, Thursday, December 17th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, social and political critic Henry Giroux speaks on the costs of neoliberalism. At 10,